Today's episode of the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by MUBI, the curated online cinema. Go to MUBI.com/filmstage for your free 1 month trial.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable. This is the spin-off podcast for the increasingly popular and Peabody Award followed on Twitter Film Stage show. That's right, on the day that on the day that Bob Dylan won Nobel Prize for Literature, the Film Stage show was followed on Twitter by the Peabody Awards. So that's meaningless, but I still wanted to tell you all. Oh, man. Well, we don't do reviews on these particular podcasts. The roundtables are dedicated to discussing random topics related to film culture as a whole. So if you have anything you'd like us to talk about, hit us up. We love listening to your crazy ideas, and often we do them. Today, we have one that was initiated by a fan. And the best way you can get in touch with us is through our many social media pages. On Twitter, you can find us being followed by the Peabody Awards. I'm just going to keep bringing that up. You can find us by looking for at Film Stage Show. You can find us on Facebook by looking for the Film Stage Show. And of course, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And let me take this opportunity to solicit your ratings and comments on iTunes. Find us, search for us, give us a comment and a rating. Let us know how you think we're doing and help other people find this podcast. It is awesome. Guys, it's been 2 weeks since we've done a roundtable. Is everybody ready for this emotionally?
I guess.
Let's do it.
All right. I actually, before we get into everything, I have a song to play for our movie plug. So, everybody, get ready.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Why are we playing One Thing Leads to Another by The Fix? That is because on Mubi right now, it is Horrific October. That means that Mubi's curators have set themselves to finding horror films of all stripes for you to enjoy throughout the month of October. Now, this particular song features heavily in a movie that I know at least Michael and I love, and that is The House of the Devil, directed by Ty West.
Yeah! Woo!
So we're all a fan. So that movie is currently on Mubi, along with The Innkeepers, which was his follow-up, as well as, and this doesn't have to do with Horrific October, but it's still pretty cool, a duo of Hal Hartley films, The Book of Life and Meanwhile. So, yeah. Mubi. Awesome, awesome films. The way it works is every day they introduce a new film, and you have 30 days to watch it. At the end of that 30 days, that movie poofs as part of The Great Departure, and then it may or may not ever come back. So it's the best it's the best parts of all streaming platforms, along with the ticking bomb device that was so often employed in Hitchcock's greatest work. You are able to download these things to your devices so you can watch them on the go without having to eat into your data. And because it's curated, you always know that these movies are going to be quality. Quality, ladies and gentlemen. So that is Mubi. You can go there and get a free month trial on us. All you have to do is go to MUBI.com/filmstage. All right. Get a little bit of a fix of the fix in this episode. I'm already regretting that joke. All right. So there were a couple of movies that came out that brought us to our first topic. We have decided that we are going to talk about foreign film directors that have come to America who we wish had had a little more success. And as I think we'll discuss, our metric for what counts as success does change from person to person. But here we are at our first topic, and that is the American Nightmare.
What? Wait, was that your title, Brian?
Yeah. Jimmy's in America, your tricks at the wheel. All right. So as I said, this topic that apparently has a laugh-worthy title, and I'll take that, was inspired because of a couple of things. First of all, immigration is a big deal this election season. That's a super rough segue. No, honestly, this is partially because of Andrea Arnold, who has brought her first American film to the theaters, and that is American Honey. Also, Christoph Gans had a live version, of Beauty and the Beast that was released that literally no one heard about. And this got us thinking, who are some foreign directors who have come to America to actually, like, try to plant their flag in Hollywood, who we wish had had greater success? This is a loaded question and a little more esoteric than what we usually do, I would say. But I think it's going to lead to some fun conversation. So, let's start off. Bill Graham, who is the director?
Are you fucking kidding me? Brian, come on. Just go first, man. If you want me to give the name, I can go ahead and give you the name, just so you don't think I'm fucking with you. But you're going first, or you're going second.
I would love to get everyone's names first, and then we can begin the conversation. So, Bill Graham, who is your director?
Okay. It is Thomas Alfredson. It is Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Really? Okay. I'm gonna want to talk to you about that. Michael Snydell, who is your choice for this?
Do I just say the name then?
Yeah, you can give us the name. Are we just doing that? What they've done. Yeah,
later. Sure. I went with one that, you know, actually their American debut was...
Come on.
It's Nimrod Antal.
Oh, okay.
And so his first debut was Control back in 2003.
Right.
And that was in Hungarian. And then his first English film was Vacancy, which is kind of a nasty little thriller that it made an okay amount of money, but I think he deserves more attention.
Now, before I give my choice, didn't Nimrod Atel have some other following success in other arenas? That's a name that I feel like I've heard continue to be bandied around.
I think he's done some music.
Nimrod, you might think of, is it Nimrod Taylor that did The Predators?
No, it is Nimrod Antal who did.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking of.
Predator.
Yeah, yeah.
So he did Predator, and then he did another film called Armored. And then most recently he did Metallica Through the Never.
Oh, again, yeah. So I interviewed him. Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, he's a nice dude.
Did you ask him good why, memory, though, according to Michael, he hadn't had more success?
No, because he was doing a fucking Metallica like movie documentary thing. So yeah. I was like, nah, this guy's in a good place. He's working with people that he wanted to work with. So.
All right. Well, that's awesome.
Sure.
All right, so
you know,
can I give a follow up?
Yeah.
One extra. Definitely Jose Padilla. He directed these awesome movies called Elite Squad and Elite Squad: The Enemy Within, and then he came to America with RoboCop, which landed with a huge fucking thud. So
is that worth checking out? The American
which one? RoboCop.
The American RoboCop.
I think the first half of it is. I think the second half is just a gnarly disaster. But it's definitely working with some ideas that, like, even Verhoeven wasn't quite working with. There's some really crazy ideas that you can tell the studio was like, no, we don't want you going there. And ultimately it got pulled back. But, yeah, the second half of that film is just a complete and utter mess.
You can't sell me a movie better than calling something a gnarly disaster.
Yeah. And I'm kind of feeling.
Yeah. It's a good time. It's a good time, guys. It is.
So my choice.
And it's got our boy. What's his face? Can I remember? Joel Kinnaman.
Are you talking about the least memorable dude on earth?
He's so good in The Killing. And
why is he our boy?
Because he's just our boy, man.
I don't feel like we have a lot of boys and a couple girls on this. I don't feel like we've agreed that Joel Kinnaman is one of them. Shea if William. Anything. And what's
Joe
his
Wright?
Name?
No. What's the other guy? The guy that's in like everything.
I know who you're talking about.
Bloodline? Is he?
Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah. That dude's crazy.
All right, that dude's my boy. Never mind. No, Michael Shannon too.
This makes it sound like we don't like actresses. I'm sorry, James Badgedale is my boy. Like James Badgedale's my boy, and I would.
He
I
was
would watch
13
him
so hours.
Good. Did you see Rubicon? Rubicon is so good.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. But he's great. And Shame, he's the best part of the. What's that stupid movie? The Lone Ranger.
Jesus!
I love me some James Badgedale. So anyway, off of JBD.
Guys, we are off the rails.
It's funny because if anyone's curious, the reason why Bill got mad at me is because he told me that I should go first because I never get any time at the end of these things to actually speak. And then when I decided to have everyone just shout their choices out, and now I've just been trying to get a word in and... It just
because you gave me fucking go first.
Bill, are you eating?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Oh my God. Okay. What is happening tonight?
Fucking fuck.
Oh my God. All right. Let me talk about the movie that I think was a movie that should have launched a career in America because of its skillful blending of art house pretension and good old fashioned creature feature, and that is a movie called Brotherhood of the Wolf. And this works for me because the movie that inspired this topic actually is directed by the man who directed Brotherhood of the Wolf. That is Christoph Gans. And I mean,
that's what you call a transition.
Brotherhood of the Wolf is like so good. It's just so good. It's so fun, and it's like nuts. And I saw this movie when it came out, which apparently was 2001, so I guess I was like 14 or maybe 15 by the time it got to America. But I mean, like, this movie has gorgeous costumes, crazy colors, a giant wolf, a crazy Frenchman who's skilled at martial arts and his Native American sidekick, and it's just amazing. And then Christoph Gans comes to America and... basically immediately signs on to the director's Kiss of Death, which is a video game adaptation called Silent Hill.
Oh, it's wonderful.
The first one. I've heard decent things about it. So I have seen Brotherhood of the Wolf, and I really enjoy that film. It's definitely got a cult following, but yeah, it didn't make much of a splash over here overseas.
No, it was weird because it was one of those rare foreign Hollywood films that, like, on the heels of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, they're like,
apparently
Americans will read subtitles if there's like hot foreign people and they're kicking the shit out of each other. And so
he
brought over Brotherhood of the Wolf, and then he did Silent Hill, which is not a bad movie. But then I'm looking at his IMDb page. Brotherhood of the Wolf was 2001. Silent Hill was 2006. His next directing credit was Beauty and the Beast 2014. And then it only got a cursory release here like 2 weeks ago.
I mean, I don't blame them. I mean, Silent Hill is an insane movie that makes almost no sense. But
it's
like,
an insane game
it's
that
so,
makes almost no sense.
No, I mean, sure, but like, even Like, it's just, even when it comes to, like, basic cinematic, like, language, it is a bizarre, bizarre film. And I can say that the two times I've seen it, I've been very drunk. So that might be part of the problem.
That film did get cut to ribbons, though, didn't it?
I believe it probably did, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a director's cut. I'd be down to watch it. I really do want to see Beauty and the Beast. Because I think this guy's got an eye. I mean, like, I think he's got some, and I'm hoping that, you know, I know he, in the past 15 years, has only made 3 films. But
he's been honing his craft.
He has put out less films.
Biding his time.
Less films in the last 15 years than Terrence Malick, which is an issue. Terrence Malick will technically, in the last year alone, have put out more films than Christoph.
Yeah, he's prolific at this point.
I know. It's crazy. Now, Bill, I think I've made a point of Christoph Gans now, so we can move on. Bill, I'm super curious. I loved Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Oh no.
Okay.
I'll just go ahead and say that. Oh
now,
no.
For anyone who doesn't know, Thomas Alfredson did Let the Right One In, the original version, which is
easily. Like, so we do have a segment coming up, and that could have easily been one of my favorite adaptations. That film is one of my favorite films, just full stop. I think it's gorgeous. I think it's beautiful. I think the 80s feel to it is just perfect. The language and the romance that the two characters kind of feel, there's very little I see with that film that I would ever think needs to be changed.
Maybe the CGI cats.
Okay, fine. Yes.
But that's a budgetary limitation. I don't think
that is. Role if I just think that one's fine.
No, I mean, you're
I might like the American remake better, honestly.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay, now you're a troll.
Yeah. This is my segment, Michael. but... Yeah, so that film is just it's about as flawless as I think a film, especially in the horror genre, which usually kind of gets shit on for being not taken seriously by a lot of critics. This film was taken seriously by a lot of people, right? It got a huge amount of critical success. It had a cult following almost immediately. And it straddles that line between fantastical kind of drama and obviously the horror elements of it. I think it's just wonderful. And it came out right in the middle of the vampire Hollywood shit show that we all kind of know about.
Right. And so this gave horror fans like a true dyed-in-the-wool vampire.
Yeah. This is it. And yeah, I mean, you don't see the main character in that film vamp out very often, but when she does, it's frightening.
What's your goddamn problem with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy?
So here's my initial issue with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I was at a press screening and they gave us a card that had all of the character names and all of their nicknames in the film, and then how they were related to each other. It was literally, it looked like a spider web.
The dramatis personae, I think, is what that's called at the beginning of a book. Yeah.
I don't know what the hell it was. I was trying to watch it like a 2.5-hour movie, and they gave me a book, and I was like, what's going on? And already it was just setting me up for failure, because I was like, wait, and because I even like I was diligent, like I arrived to the movie like 20-30 minutes early, and so I'm looking at this booklet and I'm like, oh, okay, so maybe I should try and like remember some of this. And so I started reading it, and then I started watching the movie and quickly found myself just completely outpaced. That film moves at a snail's pace, and yet somehow the information it delves out is just delved out in like waterfall bursts. It's just like all of this stuff, and you're like, whoa. And then for 5 minutes, nothing happens. And then for a minute, everything happens. And then for 5 minutes, nothing happens. And it keeps this kind of crazy rapid fire pace where it's just like slow. And then all of this information just kind of happens. And part of it is because it's following a lot of characters. It's following a lot of intricacies of the plot. And I'll give it credit that it manages to feel somewhat coherent. Even as I'm explaining this, I'm saying I was not able really to follow it all the way through. It still felt coherent. It felt like I just wasn't able to keep pace with the pace that it was trying to lay down. I've heard the book is a madhouse, right? That it's,
yeah, it's what is it? John Le Carré.
Yeah. And it happens to be that is, if I'm not mistaken, that's the same guy that did, no, he did Let the Right One In. If I'm not mistaken.
No, John Le Carré did not write Let the Right One In.
I'm sorry.
He did, however, write The Constant Gardener.
Okay.
And a Most Wanted Man from last year.
Oh, but, yeah.
See, and I liked The Most Wanted Man a lot more.
I don't know. What was that miniseries that was on AMC?
The Night Manager.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't make it through that one.
I didn't begin that one. Look. So.
I can say enough about how much I didn't really care for the film, especially kind of the final few sequences of it. But I think it says enough about just the simple fact. Yes, it made over its budget. It was budgeted at about like $20 million. It made about 80, so it made back its money more than likely. But to be honest with you, this is a guy that came off of one of the biggest critical films, kind of cult films that we've seen in a while. And he made a film that, for the most part, a lot of people were like, what? Huh? That movie?
Oh, man. And, I love Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
And that's fine.
Yeah,
but
no,
it didn't make.
Nothing you said is wrong is the funny thing. But like, as you're saying it, I'm like, yeah, I know, right? That's awesome.
Yeah, that was just my issue with it. He had very few characters to kind of work against in Let the Right One In, and I think it really allowed him to kind of hone in on those people and really give us some character moments. And I don't think it quite pulled out on Tinker Tailor Soldier side, but specifically, I mean, I can think of probably a handful of my friends that have even seen that film. And so it wasn't a big kind of critical, it wasn't a big commercial splash that I think the guy from one of the most beloved horror films of like the last 20 years probably should have made. Right.
Well, and I think,
I mean, part of it is the subject matter, right? Like that book is dense and the subject is kind of droll and it's like, who the hell wants to watch that movie? Right. It's not super exciting, but in its own way it is, right. You know, it gives you what it is at its fullest degree, but it's just like, man, he went, you know, I wish he would have made something that kind of made a splash. Now, here's my catch. He is adapting a Joe Nesbo film or a Joe Nesbo novel. Check out this cast, right?
The Snowman?
Yes.
Is this what you're talking about?
It's got Michael Fassbender. It's got Rebecca Ferguson. It's got Charlotte Gainsbourg. And it is coming out here soon. It's also got J.K. Simmons, Val Kilmer, which may be the kiss of death. I don't know. We'll see. It's also got Toby Jones. Yeah, I mean, this movie and Chloe Sevigny. Yeah, this sounds pretty damn good. So we'll see.
I think that, you know, like I said, nothing you said about Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is wrong. I do think that his switch of genre probably narrowed the amount of people who would follow him from Let the Right One In. And I also think that in general, even people who get behind like a foreign film like Let the Right One In, I don't think they follow the name as much as Hollywood or I don't want them to.
Yeah.
I think Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was a UK production, but I'm going to allow it because that is a good call because yeah, I mean, considering the noise that Let the Right One In made, the kind of non-embrace of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was
Let me mention this. Let me mention this real quick, because I failed to mention this, and this is part of the reason why I think it's kind of a shame that this film didn't make a bigger splash. Even if I didn't like it as much as some others did, it's the cast of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy: Gary Oldman, Colin Firth, Tom Hardy, Mark Strong, Ciaran Hinds, Benedict Cumberbatch. Seriously, guys, like, this movie had all the white dudes that were popular at that time. Like, just give me all.
Just all the white dudes.
All the white dudes, man. All the white dudes.
Okay. Oh, man. All right. Michael Snydell.
You know, I have not seen that one, but I will say, you know, to back up what Bill is saying a little bit, it's been interesting to see, you know, to read a lot of the criticism about Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy at the time. Was it was always like there was a preface in every review that's like, this is for you or it's not for you.
Yeah,
like it's a movie in the sense that it already requires such a learning curve, you know, even walking into the theater.
Well, I'm curious. You brought up Nimran Tal.
Yeah.
You weren't a fan of Predators and Vacancy?
No, I thought they were okay. I think it was. So originally, I was thinking about Park Chan Wook, you know, who we're going to talk about soon.
Fuck you. Stoker is amazing.
No, Stoker is amazing, but Stoker did not make a lot of money. And it was very mixed for a lot of people. But instead of doing that one, I thought Nimrod was, you know, he's had kind of an interesting career in the sense of, you know, Control's a pretty weird movie. It's a Hungarian. Have either of you guys seen it?
I have not, no.
It's a Hungarian film about a person who essentially lives in the subway station, and he makes his life by just like traveling around these different metro systems in Hungary and avoiding the cops. And then it also becomes kind of a noir film. And then at times it has like the formal stylings of something like a Tom Twicker. Is that how you say it? Like a Run Lola Run.
Yeah.
Is that not a South Korean filmmaker? It sounds like a South Korean film.
No, Nimrod Antal is he's Hungarian.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying, like, you're mixing a lot of genres, and I'm like, man, that sounds like a very South Korean thing where they're just like, yeah, it's a comedy and it's a horror and it's a drama and it's a romance.
That is true.
Oh, and it's a comedy.
European films aren't often as fluid with their genre conventions as Asian cinema is.
Guys, it's like you knew what I was. It's like you knew what I was going to say. Well, when he came to America, that fluidity was far less ingrained. So, I mean, I like Vacancy, but that's something that, you know, it feels pretty structured in the sense of, you know, when it's going to be horror, when it's going to be a setup. Like, it's a pretty standard, okay, shit isn't quite as it seems in this, you know, location. And Predators as well is a film that could use, you know, another look at the script,
yeah,
for
probably
a few more people. And that's another film that also feels weirdly grim, but then also has, I mean, if you want to talk about really interesting casts in that one, you know, that has Adrian Brody, Alice Braga, Lawrence Fishburne, Danny Trejo, Walton Goggins, and Topher Grace in a very strange role.
Lawrence Fishburne has the strangest role in that movie.
Okay. There's a lot of
playing against him.
There's a lot of suspension of disbelief, or yeah. suspension of disbelief going on. And I'm going in circles, but I guess what I just want to say is, you know, this is a director that, you know, even if his films haven't quite succeeded, he's always doing interesting things with the camera. He's willing to go into some strange places with character development as Predators is probably the best example of. And I have not, of course, I haven't seen the Metallica film and I haven't seen Armored, but again, I he's just a director I don't hear about that often. And, you know, even I hear him, you know, people just putting him a tier above someone like Paul W.S. Anderson or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there's some people who view him as more of a workman when I think, or is that what I meant? Yes. Yeah. In workman, like, yeah, a journeyman. Thank you. And I think he has more to offer than that.
All right. I'm not going to go into it too much. I was surprised that no one brought this up, maybe because no one remembers this movie. There was a director who made the film Downfall, which was the German film about the last days of Hitler. Mm-hmm. That was, I am going to fuck this up, Oliver Hirschbiegel?
Okay.
All right. No,
what was his follow-up? Is that what you're about to get into?
His follow-up was the 2007 Nicole Kidman, Daniel Craig film, The Invasion.
Really?
Yeah. Huh.
That's the Body Snatchers remake, right?
Yeah, right.
This is the movie that basically got taken away from him and then rejiggered by
James McTeague. Who did is that V for Vendetta? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And he also did The Raven. Oh shit.
Oh man.
Yeah, so
I forgot about that one.
It was kind of a bummer for him to do Downfall and then come here and do Invasion, and that first trailer looked really good, but then it came out and it was oof. But I think as far as like a resounding lack of success that none of our fans brought up, by the way,
here's
the only reason I bring it up, because I feel like he deserves something. But he's been working. He did 5 Minutes in Heaven with Liam Neeson.
Oh, that was fantastic.
Yeah, he did. Well, then he did Diana, which, you know, let's not talk about it. So
okay.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure I saw The Invasion, but I can't remember. That tells me a lot.
Says everything you need to know. So speaking of what our fans,
I keep
have said,
confusing that one with the Day the Earth Stood Still remake.
No, what? How? Oh, no. I just remember seeing Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman on screen at the same time and just thinking that I was staring into those cold baby blue eyes of Daniel Craig and just being like, is he real? I don't know. And I'm just like, did I see that movie? I can't remember.
Or do you just think that every time you see Daniel Craig? All right.
Wait, so who has Goldblum's role in the Invasion? Anybody good?
I don't know if it syncs up that correctly. Jeffrey
There's
Wright.
No comic relief.
I don't know. I haven't seen it. Yeah. Anyway,
can't
let's
remember.
Let's get on into what our fans said. This is actually going to be short. There were not many answers for this. Obviously, we'll have to pick a more popular question next time. So here we go. We have on Twitter, Fest Picks said Jean-Pierre Genoux. Oh my god, I don't know how to say that, which is sad. Waleed said, that's easy, Louis Buñuel. And then we have Mr. Cool saying John Woo. Ashavit 23 Film, I'm going to assume is the way to say this person's name. Boaz Davidson. John Nix said Nicholas Winding Refn. Sonal Pandya said Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, which will always be a fun name to say. And then Rob Bickmore said, if more success equals should have made better films rather than not being appreciated, then John Woo tops my list. And as promised, it was a super short Rockin' Robin round robin for that time.
As we were talking about in Slack, I would have picked John Woo, but Face Off is
amazing. Is the problem.
So damn
that
fun.
Statement. You take that, Rob Bickmore. Face Off is great.
Wasn't his first film Hard Target?
That, I don't think that was that American though? Was that an American production?
It's got Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Okay, well then, yeah. I mean, but whatever you say about him, you can never say he's not a success because he made Face Off.
Okay.
The movie where Nicolas Cage and John Travolta switch fucking faces. Oh my God. I can't get over that movie existing. That's the 90s for you. God bless him. I think Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck is a crazy answer because it's so true, because he did The Lives of Others and then The Tourist.
Oh, man. This which, dude,
wait, that was the Lives of Others director? What?
Yeah.
If you had known that, would you have changed your answer?
No, I only made it halfway through The Tourist, so I'm not really sure.
Oh, so you're not conversant. Yeah, no, it's The Lives of Others is like an out-and-out masterpiece, and then he made The Tourist, which, hoo boy. All right, well, let's get into our second topic. Whew. It's funny when you realize stuff like that, and it's kind of a shame that these people who made, you know, really good movies suddenly just got sucked into the mire somehow. But hopefully some of them will crawl their way back out with Face Off 2. Face Off. So the next came from Twitter. A fan of ours asked us to talk about something. And so here we are with great adaptations.
I wonder who wrote the book of love. Tell me folk who wrote the book of love. I've got to know the answer.
I almost did Beatles paperback writer, but having the Beatles twice on this podcast feels like it would really be courting some kind of lawsuit. So,
you do Buckle Up by Magnetic Fields as well.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Nah, we stuck with this one. All right, so, as I said, we have Donnie, and I apologize in advance, Pacheco, to thank for this. He asked us about this, and I figured, you know, we've talked about the best remakes. We've talked about our ideal remakes. We've talked about film versions of true stories. And maybe one day, just maybe, we will talk about songs that we want to see as movies, which would, you know, obviously be Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles. But right now, we're going to talk about our favorite movie adaptations of books, or what we think are the best adaptations of a book. This was a point of some controversy as we were trying to decide what we were going to talk about. So, gentlemen, let us get into it. Michael Snydell, you...
No.
Yes, Michael Snydell. You said you were going to have trouble with this because you...
No, this one read? Was the easier one.
You can't read. Is that what you said to me?
Yes, I said I'm illiterate. That's correct. You asshole.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, I would like for you to lay it on us. What, in your mind, is the best adaptation of a book?
Well, guys, I did have some trouble with this for a bit, but then I was thinking about it more, and the one I had to go with was Double Indemnity. Ooh. And there's just a lot of fun stuff to talk about with Double Indemnity in terms of the adaptation part. So Double Indemnity was originally written by James M. Cain, you know, who's one of the pioneers of noir. Hard-boiled crime. He actually wrote the original book. He based it on a novella on a 1927 murder where a married woman and her lover, killed her husband and then, you know, took out a big insurance policy, thus the Double Indemnity. And it's a good novel, and it's very obvious that it's a building block and a canonical foundation for what the genre becomes. But the film is far more interesting, and there's a lot of things that are really interesting about it. But the best place to start is that Hollywood was really worried about making this one. And I'm going to bring up this great quote. So this is from Joseph Breen at the Hayes office. And just to give a quick thing, there was a thing called the Hays Code. Guys, can you help me with timing? When was the Hays Code?
I honestly have no idea. Would you like to look it up on the computer? 1930
to 1968.
Okay.
And the Hays Code was that there were, to be as broad and vague as possible, it was that there were certain things that you could not show in movies because they were seen as too scandalous, and movie studios were under the impression that it would influence people to do things that were amoral.
Right.
And so Joseph Brina's – exactly. That would have been the better way to put it. But Joseph Breen has this wonderful quote where here's what he said about the original Double Indemnity, the novel. The general low tone and sordid flavor of this story makes it, in our judgment, thoroughly unacceptable for screen presentation before mixed audiences in the theater. I am sure you agree that it is most important to avoid what the code calls the hardening of audiences, especially those who are young and impressionable to the thought and fact of crime.
So what he said in modern parlance is, if men and women or boys and girls watch this movie together, they're going to get busy. Pretty much. They're going to
get busy and then murder someone and, you know, all the normal things that teens want to do.
This movie will incite couples to fuck and then murder. Sounds like
and
a great
to commit
movie.
Fraud.
sounds like a fantastic movie.
Sounds like all the movies your parents warned you about.
So there were a bunch of different movie studios that were all very interested in this book, despite the fact that Joseph Breen was a spoil sport. And so what they had to do is they had to make it so that Walter Neff, Fred McMurray, and Phyllis Dietrichson, Barbara Stanwyck, would receive some sort of comeuppance in the film. That is the only way that they could adapt the novel. So the one other very interesting – well, not one other, but the other interesting tidbit I'll bring up for right now is that James M. Cain was not available to write the script. So it was actually Billy Wilder went to Raymond Chandler, who was another major pioneer of hard-boiled. Yes, yeah. Exactly. So again, like there are a lot of differences from the original novel to the film, which is Double Indemnity's in probably my top 10. And it's not that James M. Cain's dialogue was bad or anything, but it's this very self-consciously stiff, hard-boiled prose that really doesn't work, you know, in the rapid-fire delivery of a film like Double Indemnity. So it just for that reason, for just how memorable and how sharp a Double Indemnity is, I have to pick that one because it's a great novel, but the movie absolutely improves on it.
Awesome. I gotta say, I nearly picked like three different noir adaptations of hard-boiled crime novels. I was like, oh, you know, The Maltese Falcon or The Long Kiss Goodnight, or, you know, just anything really. Like, if it's got Bogart in it and he's wearing a fedora, odds are it was adapted and it's great. But I decided to shy away from that, and I'm going to give Bill his wish. I'm going to let him go last. I had a lot of options here. I'll throw out a couple of things so people know what I was thinking of. James Ellroy's novel, L.A. Confidential, that got turned into a movie by the sadly recently departed.
Yep.
And now I can't remember his name, so I feel just awful. Anyone going to help me out? My nope. IMDb isn't working, honestly, so I don't. I kind of
wait. So
I
wait,
can't remember
what did you
the
ask?
Name of the director of L.A. Confidential.
Oh, Curtis Hanson.
Curtis Hanson. So L.A. Confidential was going to be one of mine.
Who just passed away, actually,
That's
unfortunately.
What I literally just said. literally just said, fuck. You son of a bitch. All right. So we know that no one's listening to me. I'm just going to keep talking anyway. So L.A. Confidential by Curtis Hanson. And that was a screenplay by him and Brian Helgeland. Helgeland? We all know who
we'll go with
about.
That.
The director of A Knight's Tale.
Yep.
So that was one of them. That's a great one. We all, I think, bandied about Jaws and Jurassic Park. And that's great. I did, however, end up settling on frequent subject of this show, apparently, Joe Wright. Joe Wright.
Oh, no. You picked Anakin.
I'm going to...
Just fucking pick this?
No, first of all, Anna Karenina by Joe Wright, I wanna point out, we only talked about that in terms of its music.
Yes.
So, I would like a little bit of credit, because now I'm actually going to talk about the film.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Longest
novel ever.
This was a screenplay that was adapted by Tom Stoppard, who is a fantastic playwright in his own right. And it's I think I've brought it up before. I have read the book Anna Karenina 3 times, and I'm coming up on the moment where I'm probably going to read it for the 4th. And this is a dense fucking book. Like, this is a crazy huge book, and somehow Stoppard's writing with Joe Wright's direction, and I'm gonna look up the editor because she deserves a shout out, Melanie Ann Oliver. I mean, these people trim it to within an inch of its life but leave it like still fully fleshed out and breathing, and that's an incredible feat. Now, I nearly chose another Joe Wright adaptation, Atonement, and I decided not to. Because, and this was the distinction that I made, Atonement, when I watched it, was precisely what I saw in my head as I was reading the book. Which is awesome, but that feels more like a transcription to me. Which is one of the reasons why I decided not to do the Maltese Falcon or some of the noir ones, because there wasn't really a change or anything to it that made it feel like an adaptation, like they'd made it their own. Atonement is still a fantastic movie, but I couldn't get behind it. The same for The Road. The Road didn't really do anything other than put the words on the page into images on the screen. Whereas Anna Karenina has this super inventive visual style where everything is taking place on a theater stage, and the only time it ever goes outside is when it's following Constantine Levin. And people are like climbing up in the footholds and the catwalks above. And when there's a horse race, they stage it to look like, you know, the horses are running on and off of the stage and everything. It's just, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's so weird. And I can't imagine them having shot this like a regular costume drama period piece. Like this weird metatextual theater set with its chorus lines and its orchestra and everything is just perfect. And I'm curious, I know I've read it since the movie came out, but I'm curious if on this next time, after having seen the movie so much more and had it grow in my estimation, if that's going to like start to influence it somehow. And yeah, that's why I think that Anna Karenina is my favorite adaptation of a book. In movie form. Yes.
Golf clap.
I was about to say, is that like, you know, I know maybe not everyone is a fan of Anna Karenina, but I feel like I made a strong defense.
No, I actually really like that movie, but I don't have a lot to say about it.
Yeah, and like I said, Atonement is great, but it, you know, I still love that movie, but it really is. It's like, if it's a little too close, like what Mike was saying, you know, you want something that's going to surpass or do something interesting with or go beyond. And so that's what I went for. Anna Karenina, 2012. Okay. Bill Graham.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited to hear what you chose.
Okay. So this one might have been kind of an easy one for a lot of people, because both the film And I think the book is now kind of retroactively pretty well received. It is Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men that was adapted by the Coen brothers. This film, let me put it bluntly. Okay. This film in 2007 launched the career and gave us one of the creepiest villains that have ever been committed to film in Javier Bardem, Anton Chigurh. This dude is fucking just crazy, and he was an actor that was kind of here and there. But this film specifically put him on the map. It kind of did something that I think is unfortunate, though, because it kind of typecast him. You know, you can see him in Skyfall, where he is great, but he also plays a crazy, crazy villain in that film as well. This film, though, specifically is just... It's hard to, if you haven't read the book and then seen the movie, this is one of the few examples that I can think of where I read the book shortly before I watched the film, and it only enhanced my appreciation of the film itself. And that's, for me at least, that's very rare. Most of the time I'm nitpicking what is taken out, what is left in, choices, changes, things like that. Part of it is simply because No Country for Old Men is only about 300 pages. I think in hardback form it's listed at 320. So it's a short, quick read. And it's also a book that, and I'm trying to find some of the background of this. It doesn't say it here, but I remember kind of looking into it originally, and this was No Country for Old Men, if I'm not mistaken, was originally set to be a play. And that was Cormac McCarthy's idea behind it. And basically what he ended up doing was he just said, well, if you fuckers don't want to make this into a play, I'm just going to publish it. Fine. And so he just published it. And what it does is it kind of reads like a play, or if you've read a screenplay, where each of the characters don't get introductions in each scene. So you never really know who's talking. It's kind of interesting because characters just talk, and sometimes they give you context clues. They say a character that they're talking to. But for the most part, it jumps from scene to scene to scene without a whole lot of contextual detail, or without a lot of out-and-out detail about who is talking, what the sequence is, things like that. I think I remember even some of the punctuation is missing. It's a strange book to read because of its format, and then it's... because of that, it kind of reads like a screenplay. It reads very quick. It's rapid fire. And the way it was adapted was basically just straight up adapted. It seemed like they pretty much fit all the major elements that you could want from the book into the film. And it even carries over into its kind of final elements when a character dies that a lot of people aren't expecting to die, and you start to realize that maybe he wasn't the main character after all. And that threw a lot of people off. And I think it still confuses a lot of people that have watched that film and only watched that film and haven't kind of dug deeper and maybe read the novel or read any kind of the critical talking and reviews and things like that, analysis of the film. And, you know, I don't want to get into spoilers, but this is a film that I think it's sitting right at the 2 hour mark. It's 122 minutes. It is, as far as I'm concerned, the perfect runtime for this plot. it moves very briskly. Anton Chigurh is a force of nature throughout, and it's both wicked and hilarious all at the same time. I love Woody Harrelson in this film. I think it's one of his best roles in a while up to that point. Josh Brolin is great. And even Tommy Lee Jones in his small role in the film, I think is quietly great. But I think more than anything, this film just really announces kind of what a huge presence kind of Cormac McCarthy has, how much of a touch he has for kind of the Texas country area. And it's really kind of lit a fire on him as a novelist to adapt that has a very rich history. He's had, I believe, to this point, one or two other adaptions before this point, but this was really the one that kind of brought him back into the fold. And then obviously The Road happened, and then The Counselor, which we don't have to talk about.
I love The Counselor.
And, you know, there's just more that is surely coming down the pike. I believe Blood Meridian is one of those films that
they
a lot of
been
people
trying yeah, to they, make Blood Meridian for.
Yeah.
Is that happening again or.
I don't know. You what? I know James Franco was like, I'm going to make Blood Meridian. And
well,
people
fuck
were
that.
Like, no, that's not true at all. Ridley Scott wanted to do it.
Yep. Ridley Scott did.
No, that's not true at all.
No, Ridley Scott wanted to make. He wanted to.
No,
make
it, I'm saying that's nearly as awful happen. To me as yeah. as no, James Franco. Honestly,
so many. I mean, I wouldn't want Ridley Scott to do it. I wouldn't want James Franco to do it. I was cool with the idea of John Hillcoat doing it, but that's about it. All the Pretty yeah. Horses was based on a Cormac McCarthy novel.
Yeah,
I didn't. Franco made another Cormac McCarthy novel, didn't he?
He might have. I don't know.
I can't remember what it was called, and now I again cannot seem to make my computer work.
Bill,
Child
this
of
might...
God. Child of God was the one yeah. that fucking that guy made.
Bill, yeah. from what I remember, yeah, I mean, I know you were talking about how faithful it is. It's been a while since I've read the book. Isn't there a subplot that's left out, though? I mean, I know I understand why they did, but for some reason, I'm vaguely remembering there was a subplot in the book version that's left out of the movie. Am I misremembering this?
I think part of that may have been dealing with Tommy Lee Jones' character, and I think they left it out to kind of be vague and to kind of punch up the ending. But I can't remember that subplot specifically that you're kind of referencing. It's been a while since I've read the book. I probably read it like I said, I pretty much read it right before I saw the film. So it was in 2007 when I read it. And so yeah.
I kind of have a question too, generally for all you guys. I guess this is a case by case basis, but you know, you talk to some people, especially people who are really, especially if you read the book beforehand, they want films to be very faithful. Mm-hmm. When you guys see adaptations and you're familiar with the novels, is faithfulness a major factor in the quality for you guys?
So my general rule is if I don't have a year to digest a book and kind of get it out of my system before I see a film, I won't read it. I just cannot read a book and then see a film, even if the movie is a good adaptation of it, even if it makes changes that are better, whatever it may be, I just cannot see it. I can, however, read a book and then see a television series made out of it, notably like Game of Thrones or something like that. I don't have as much issue because they're usually going piece by piece and they're delving it out slowly anyways. I think that just has a completely different feel to it. But yeah, I can't read a book and then go see it that same weekend. That just drives me nuts.
I would say I don't really know, because I know that there have been some movies that, through their earnest attempt to be a faithful adaptation, have kind of limited themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, Jurassic Park the book and Jurassic Park the movie are nothing alike.
Yeah.
But I like them both equally, because I think mm-hmm. one of them, Jurassic Park is simply an extraction of the idea of the novel and then using it to create a different kind of story, which mm-hmm. I'm fine with. I don't think I'd want to see a more faithful adaptation of Jurassic Park. Now, no. Something like Anna Karenina, if they fucked around with it, I probably would have been pissed about. But then L.A. Confidential is very much in line with the book in terms of, like, tone and cynicism, but it does soften the characters a little bit, and it cuts out, like, a huge, massive subplot involving a Walt Disney stand-in, if you can believe that. And that, I mean, like, but you can see the need for those changes. So, like, I guess if I can understand the choices that were made, or if the movie is very clearly attempting to just do something else entirely, but with that idea, I'm fine with it. So, no, faithfulness is not super important to me. But, like, Anna Karenina, I have an emotional attachment to, so I had a lot riding on that. I'm curious to see what they do with the novel Bel Canto, which is being made into a movie now.
Hmm.
And I would probably attach that same sense of, like, dear God, please don't fuck this up, please be pretty close to the novel, to anything done by Cormac McCarthy.
Hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think for the most part, changes can usually be good. We'll go ahead.
I was going to say, did any of you see the movie Blindness?
Yes. No, I didn't see the movie. I read the book, unfortunately. So
I read the book. The book is great. And then
yes.
The movie is super close to the book. But it's not
good.
Yeah,
but I just can't see that. That just seems to me to be an impossible film to adapt or book to adapt.
Yeah.
There's a few of those that people give a good hoorah effort to, and you're just like, yeah, good effort. But yeah,
wasn't that actually Morales, guys?
Yeah.
The City of God. Constant. Yeah.
Another adaptation.
And it's Jose Saramago,
yes.
I believe, is the writer.
He actually wrote a sequel to that book called Seeing, wherein the population of the unnamed city goes out for election day, and almost every ballot that gets turned in is left blank. And I'm, like, super hard trying to rally America into doing that. yeah, I mean, like, if you read Blindness, the book, and then watch the movie, you'll be hard pressed to find many differences between the two, but you know, the book is very clearly using this situation as a way to talk about things. And because it's a book, it can take those digressions and kind of go into that ethereal liminal layer above the action where it can, like, engage with those ideas openly. And the movie's just like, here, watch a bunch of people get fucking beaten, raped, and then they're all blind, by the way. And it's like, okay, this all happened in the book, but it didn't happen like this.
In front of your eyes?
Yeah. So that's a movie that's trying to, and succeeds in being very faithful, but to its detriment, and maybe could have, like, just taken the idea and not run with it quite as hard as it did.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see what our distinguished fans all decided to tell us. We're going to have a few more than we had for the last one, but I will still be surprised if we don't get it all done in a single Rock and Robin. So here we go. Tweets. Rapscallion said Return of the King or Jaws or The Princess Bride or Stand By Me or Silence of the Lambs or Forrest Gump period or Jaws. Pitt. My top three: Fight Club, The Godfather 1 and 2, The Shawshank Redemption. Pitt. That's technically four. Zod Snapped Neck says Gone Girl. Justin Mercado says Fight Club actually improves the book. Same with Drive. The film version of Breakfast of Champions, however, is the worst. Jeremy Beck says A Clockwork Orange, which I'm going to do a sidebar. Clockwork Orange, the movie, leaves out the pivotal last chapter of the book. I think it's a terrible adaptation, but a good film. He then also says Atonement and The Godfather. Tyler says Jurassic Park, Clockwork Orange, Gone Girl, The Shining, No Country for Old Men, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Omar 2049 says Blade Runner, Logan Noble, that's easy, Jaws, Jaws all day. Mitch Hell McDonald, good Halloween Twitter handle, says how basic is it for me to say Gone Girl and Perks of Being a Wallflower? Super basic, but acceptable. On Facebook, Eric Marshall Main says, 10 things I hate about you, so much easier to understand. Angelo Thomas says, The Wizard of Oz, which is a good choice. Rob Bickmore says, All the President's Men, The Godfather, Jaws. Films from other decades are available, but nowhere near as good. Then we have, and I apologize, Sepe Rafi, Blade Runner, The Age of Innocence, Solaris, Brendan Edward Kennedy, I'd say, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, but I feel like that would be cheating. And then, of course, we have my wife who says, Red Dragon, The Green Mile, The Golden Compass. People can argue with me on that one, and I'll slay them. Where the Wild Things Are, and Golden Lord of the Compass Rings, Fellowship terrible. Of the Ring. I could probably go on, but those are the best. And that is that for our feedback. So, I gotta say, we got some pretty good ones. I'm surprised how many of them were really recent and how many of them were repeated.
Yeah. My big issue with this was, I guess I just haven't read that many great books that were great book adaptations, I should say.
Yeah,
so
like,
there's
I've never
a lot
read
of
The Godfather.
Yeah, there's a lot of great movies out there that were adapted from books that I've just never bothered to read the book.
Same.
Jaws.
Yeah, Jaws. I just, sorry, Peter Benchley. You're my boy, Peter Benchley, but sorry.
He's another boy
is
of
Spielberg's
ours.
Jaws faithful? Do you guys know that?
No, it's Jaws is not faithful. Steven Spielberg, no. I think, is on record as saying that in the book he was actively rooting for the shark. Because there's like, like the mayor is keeping the town open because he has to like pay off the mob and like everyone's cheating on everyone.
So that's the funny thing about Jaws is it's the same dude that wrote it is the same dude that adapted it. So, Peter Benchley, it's his first screenplay credit.
But I thought Spielberg was like day to day being like, you know what, we're throwing out.
But I mean, maybe. I don't know how much that kind of played out on set, but it was definitely Peter Benchley, you know, he basically was like, I'll adapt it.
You know what's crazy is I don't think anyone said Train Spotting, which now to me feels like a huge missed opportunity, and I'm going to kick myself about that as I edit this.
I still haven't read that either. So.
Oh, it's super good. It's really good. So that is all for today. Everybody, thank you for joining us. You can, of course, follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Follow us on Facebook by searching for The Film Stage Show. And don't forget that we are brought to you by MUBI. I'm not going to play the fix over this plug. MUBI, the curated online cinema that during the month of October is doing Horrific October. Maybe I should get some thunder and lightning sound effects when I say that. I could probably pull that off. Anyway, Horrific October. Their curators are going to pick out some fantastic horror films for you to watch. Like we said earlier, you can watch the films, two of the films, Die West. Also, there's something called The Reflecting Skin, which is under their Horrific October banner, and I don't know what it's about, but it looks creepy as hell. So I'm super excited to watch that one. That's it. All you gotta do is go to MUBI.com, that's MUBI.com/filmstageshow, and we will give you 1 month free to enjoy MUBI and everything that it has to offer. So, that's all. If you have anything that you would like us to talk about next time, write it in a book. Publish that book. Get that book adapted into a movie. We will review that movie, and we will see your suggestion. Speaking of contacting us, you can find us at the following places. Michael Snydell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you constantly kind of forget that we do this at the end of every episode.
No, I know. I'm zoning tonight. Yeah, you can find me talking about how I should read more at Twitter at Snide Owl. You can also read things from me at the Film Stage and Vague Visages this week. I'll have a reviews of The Handmaiden and what is that Farhadi film called? The Salesman tomorrow. So that's on Friday. So by the time this will be up, it should be up.
That's Michael Snidell. He's better on paper, people. Looks like. Bill Graham, what about yourself?
You can find me potentially cracking open Anna Karenina, finally, on Twitter at CableBFG. And then you can also find me writing about movies on the Film Stage and also Film Stage or FreshFiction.tv.
All right, and I'm Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on Twitter live tweeting my rereads of classic Russian novels at Brian J. Rowan. You can find my personal site, dearfilm.net. Of course, I have a bunch of stuff on thefilmstage.com. I will actually have my Hannah Townsend interview up soon. I know I keep plugging it, it never happens, but I promise it's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, join us next time we speak. We will be reviewing The Accountant. Until then, thank you for joining us, and we will see you then.